Welcome to the Deep Dive. We take the sources you give us, articles, notes, analyses, and, well, we cut through the noise to get you the core insights.
That's the idea.
And today, we're tackling something really fascinating. It's the huge success, seemingly out of nowhere, of Acharya Prashant's book, Truth Without Apology.
Yeah, it's definitely a phenomenon worth digging into. Our mission today really is to unpack the paradox here. I mean, this book isn't designed to be comforting.
Not at all.
The sources all agree it actively avoids soothing the reader. And yet, boom, number one bestseller, metaphysics, philosophy, mysticism, straight to the top. So the question is, why this appetite for discomfort?
That's exactly it. That's the tension, right?
Yeah.
It's described again and again as offering ruthless clarity over soothing fiction.
A mirror, not a cushion.
Right. A mirror, not a cushion. So in a world kind of drowning in feel-good advice and easy answers, what does this huge immediate success tell us about what people are actually maybe craving? Are we seeing like a collective impatience with just scratching the surface?
Well, the numbers certainly suggest something's changing. This isn't just some small niche thing hitting big.
Okay, let's look at the scale first, because it's not just topping philosophy charts. The sources show it's been hanging around the top three on the overall Amazon list.
Yeah, for quite a while.
For a while now. Up against the biggest mainstream books in the country. I mean, for a dense philosophical work, it's pretty staggering.
And it seems the publisher, HarperCollins India, kind of saw this coming, or at least understood the potential. At the official launch in New Delhi, that was September 7th, 2025, the publisher, Sachin Sharma, called it a bold and uncompromising book.
Much like the author himself, apparently.
Exactly. He wasn't promising an easy ride. He actually used the phrase silent revolution for what this book could represent in spiritual writing.
A silent revolution. Okay, so what's actually in the book that's causing this stir? I mean, the core themes are pretty fundamental, right?
Absolutely. It goes straight for the big ones. Fear, desire, love versus dependence, freedom versus just acting out our conditioning, suffering, self-deception, all of it.
The promise being to show life, well, as it is, without excuses, without apology.
And the person delivering this message, Acharya Prashant, he's not exactly new to this. He's a philosopher, yeah, but also a best-selling author with over 160 books.
160? Wow.
Yeah. And critically, his online reach is enormous. The sources put his following at over 90 million globally.
90 million. That makes him the most followed spiritual teacher online today, doesn't it?
Apparently so. He's also lectured extensively, you know, IITs, IAMs, top institutions. So he bridges that gap between deep philosophy and, well, reaching people where they are now.
Okay, so that sets the stage. Let's talk about the how. How does this uncompromising message get delivered, especially now in our, you know, famously short attention span era? The structure seems key here.
Definitely. The sources mention it's broken down into, what, 180, maybe 200 chapters?
Yeah, I read that number. And they're short, like really short, single pages.
Right. Which sounds accessible, maybe even bite-sized. But the author's explanation is, well, it's philosophical, not just practical.
Okay.
He says the brevity isn't just for easy reading. It's meant to mirror how truth itself works. It strikes instantly, like lightning, like a sudden bolt. It's not something you slowly work up to. It just hits you.
Like lightning. I get the metaphor, that sudden flash of insight. But does it stick? I mean, if it's instant, does it actually sink in?
Yeah.
Or is there a risk it just becomes another piece of quickly consumed, maybe superficial content?
That's the critical point, and the book's structure seems designed to avoid that trap. These short chapters aren't meant to be disposable little wisdom nuggets.
Yeah.
Instead, they aim for what he calls arrow-like depth and piercing intensity. The goal is to be effective in a snap, a bit like Zen Koan, you know? That paradox designed to jolt you into understanding.
Ah, okay. So it's about depth, not just speed. Instantaneous depth versus superficial scrolling. That makes sense. And he ties this into a wider cultural issue, doesn't he? This idea of horizontal proliferation.
Exactly. He points out we have this incredible breadth of information now more than ever before. That's the horizontal spread. But we're lacking depth, vertical depth.
Like endlessly scrolling social media feeds, you see a million things.
But nothing really lands. Nothing fundamentally changes your perspective. So the book tries to use that modern preference for quick hits, but deliver something substantial, something deep right in that moment.
And the reader feedback seems to back that up. We saw quotes like, every page pierces, every word awakens.
Yeah, that captures it well.
And another one noted, the book is made up of 180 short chapters, each one small in size, but immensely deep in impact. You don't rush through them, you sit with them.
Yeah.
So the brevity isn't an excuse to skim.
No, it's almost the opposite. It's an invitation to stop right there and actually reflect, something we rarely do with most content now.
Which leads us straight into the author's style, his tone. The publisher called it almost abrasive sometimes. Now, given that people often turn to spiritual guidance for comfort, for solace,
yeah.
Why this commitment to, well, bluntness? Isn't kindness, compassion part of the deal usually?
This is really core to his philosophy of teaching, it seems. He argues the bluntness isn't just his personality. He calls it a requirement of my relationship with the seekers.
A requirement? How so?
He basically suggests that we, especially in modern society, have had enough mollycoddling. Too much soothing, maybe.
Implying we're already sort of numbing ourselves.
Precisely. He uses that stark medical analogy you mentioned earlier. He sees his role like a doctor needing to perform surgery or pull a rotten tooth. It hurts.
Yeah.
But if that's the only way to address the underlying disease, then offering a comforting lie, a sugar pill, wouldn't actually be compassionate at all. It might even be harmful. So the necessary treatment, even if painful, is the truly compassionate act.
Okay, let's stay with that pain idea for a second. Because the sources make a crucial distinction about where the pain comes from. He's saying the book doesn't inflict the pain, right?
Exactly. It's more like the pain was already there, deep down, but we were suppressing it, using, as he puts it, sedatives and entertainments to keep it numb.
So the book acts like pulling off the bandage, or maybe stopping the anesthetic.
Something like that. So the discomfort felt when reading isn't new pain being created, it's the sudden, shocking awareness of the pain we were already carrying but ignoring. The book's job, then, is to bring life back to life by cutting through the numbness.
That definitely reframes things. It's not about being harsh for harshness' sake. It's about revealing what's already real. And this connects to his take on a specific concept, Satya Shiel, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. Shiel, it's a Hindi term, often gets translated as good conduct, character, maybe moral bearing. And traditionally, we think of Shiel as being gentle, polite, you know, affable.
The nice guy definition.
Right. But he completely challenges that. He redefines Satya Shiel, which means truthful conduct, as absolute, one-pointed devotion towards the truth and only the truth.
So if telling the unvarnished truth requires being blunt or challenging or even making someone uncomfortable,
then that bluntness, that directness, is the highest form of Shiel, according to him. Prioritizing truth over social niceties or temporary comfort becomes the real moral imperative.
And looking at the massive self-help industry through that lens, his critique makes a lot of sense. He calls most of it the ego treating the ego.
Yeah, that phrase really cuts through, doesn't it? If the ego or sense of self, our insecurities, our attachments, is both the problem and the one trying to fix the problem.
You're just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, as they say.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. You might feel a bit better temporarily, you might manage symptoms, but you're reinforcing the very mechanism, the self-deception, that caused the issue. His approach, with truth without apology, seems aimed squarely at dismantling that whole structure.
Okay, so moving on from the style. Mm-hmm. What's also striking is the sheer range of topics he tackles, all from this core philosophical base.
Absolutely. It's not just inner life stuff. The sources list climate change, capitalism, veganism, social justice, technology, religion, economics. It's a huge spread.
Which isn't typical for, say, a traditional Vedanta teacher. So maybe we should quickly unpack Vedanta for anyone listening who isn't familiar. How does ancient philosophy connect to, I don't know, economic policy?
Sure. So Vedanta is a major school of Hindu philosophy rooted mainly in the Upanishads. It's fundamentally about understanding the ultimate nature of reality, the nature of the self, capital S self, and your relationship to Brahman, or the ultimate reality. Big questions. Who am I, really? What is all this?
Right. So the connection becomes, if the individual human, the experiencer, as he calls them, is operating from a place of illusion or self-deception, which is the core Vedantic problem, then everything that person creates or interacts with
is going to be flawed, too. Our economic systems, our environmental policies, our social structures, our technology, all of it reflects our inner state.
That's exactly his point. He pushes back against being labeled just a guru or a public intellectual. Right. He says he has to talk about everything because the experiencer, the human being, the seer, lies at the center of all life.
He draws a direct line from, say, a decline in philosophical depth in society to corruption in popular culture, and then links that to things like the climate crisis. His conclusion is stark. We are the link. Our inner world shapes the outer world, full stop.
The human condition is the root cause, basically. And speaking of connecting the inner and outer, his own personal approach to books is quite revealing, especially for you, the learner, listening to this.
Oh, yeah. He takes acquiring knowledge incredibly seriously. He says before buying a book, he really examines his own mind. What am I missing? What insight do I genuinely need? He actually says the relationship with a book can be more important than the relationship we have with persons.
Wow. More important than with people. Why?
Because, he argues, in a great book, the author has poured the distilled essence of his being into those pages. You're getting the absolute best, most refined thoughts of someone, maybe someone from centuries ago, across the world.
Like direct access to their deepest insights without any of the day-to-day distractions you get with people.
Exactly. It's access to profound reflection. So for him, engaging with a book is a really serious commitment, not just casual consumption.
Okay, so pulling all these threads together, the lightning strike format, the bracing honesty, the connection between our inner state and global crises, What's the ultimate takeaway from Truth Without Apology?
I think the sources suggest it's fundamentally a call, not a consolation. It's not trying to make you feel better. It's challenging you to show up to life without your usual masks, your excuses. That clarity, however uncomfortable, is positioned as the starting point for any real change.
And the way the public has responded to that immediate bestseller status really does suggest a shift. Maybe people are tired of the usual platitudes. There seems to be a real hunger for something, well, uncompromising, something authentic, even if it stings a bit.
Yeah, maybe we're ready for the mirror after all. And it's worth noting the effort involved in creating that mirror. The sources mentioned he specifically wrote parts of it in Goa, seeking isolation for precision and perfection.
Right, sacrificing his own comfort to achieve that radical clarity for the reader. It reflects the intensity of the work itself.
Definitely.
So if realizing painful truths only happens when we finally stop taking the sedatives and drop the comforting illusions, here's a final thought for you, the learner. What common sweet lie, or perhaps carefully curated illusion, maybe about your job or relationship, even your own abilities might you be clinging to right now, just to avoid facing a difficult truth that really demands action, however painful that action might be. Something to chew on. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.